All right. Well, if we can get to 2 Kings chapter 8, that's where we're going to start today. Told you to get a little political here. Elisha is going to insert himself into the political process. And so I guess the point here is that, whoever the author of Kings has been making this very clear, that God and his prophets are not just speaking to Israel, they speak to the nations. And God is sovereign not just in Israel, but in all the nations. And so we know Elisha influences Israel, but in this section he's also going to be used to determine who's going to rule Syria, which is kind of interesting. What's the prophet of God doing in Damascus, deciding who the king of Syria is going to be? And each episode in this section is going to enhance God's sovereignty. So our thing here is that God rules the prophets, the people, the kings, and the political process, and it's a clear indication of his absolute sovereignty, and that has not changed. That is still true today. No matter who is in power, God is still on the throne. God is still sovereign. He still decides who these rulers are. And a lot of times we get the rulers that we deserve. So I think God is sovereign in that in every way, good, bad, and everywhere in between, which is where most of our political people end up, somewhere in between. All right, so let's read the first six verses of chapter 8. Now this is a little bit of a... It's almost like a little cameo appearance for somebody we had earlier. And she's back, if you remember the Shunammite woman from earlier in the book. It says, "Now Elisha had said to the woman whose son he had restored to life." Remember that Shunammite woman's died. Elisha restores him to life. "Arise and depart with your household and sojourn wherever you can, for the Lord has called for a famine, and it will come upon the land for 7 years. So the woman arose and did according to the word of the man of God. She went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines 7 years. And at the end of the 7 years, when the woman returned to the land of from the land of the Philistines, she went to appeal to the king for her house and her land. Now the king was talking with Gehazi," just coincidentally probably, "the servant of the man of God," that was sarcasm by the way, "saying, 'Tell me all the great things that Elisha has done.' And while he was telling the king how Elisha had restored the dead to life, behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life appealed to the king for her house and her land. And Gehazi said, 'My lord, O king, here is the woman, and here is her son whom Elisha restored to life.' And when the king asked the woman, she told him. So the king appointed an official for her, saying, 'Restore all that was hers, together with all the produce of the fields from the day that she left the land until now.'" Wow. So, yeah, again, sovereign putting this whole thing together right here. Now, notice that Gehazi is there talking to the king. If you remember, Gehazi is the servant that got struck with leprosy after the whole Naaman episode. So we can assume one of two things. Either this happened before that, or Gehazi gets leprosy kind of like Naaman had it, where it wasn't totally debilitating yet, and he can still be in common company, and it hasn't gotten to that point yet. Okay? But God cares for the destitute. God cares for the widow. God cares for the orphan. Isn't that appropriate for today's Sunday? And remember the Shunammite woman from 2 Kings chapter 4. This is that same woman that we had, so four chapters later. The woman whom Elisha helped, she reappears. And after acting on the prophet's advice, because the prophet had told her, Elisha had said, "There's a famine coming. So get out of here. Go somewhere else." And this was common. I mean, you think Joseph, right? Think Joseph in Egypt building up stuff for the famine. And where do all his brothers come to get food? They come to Egypt because Egypt has been storing it up. And this has happened before in Scripture. So get out of there. And she chooses to go to, that's a misspelling, sorry, Philistia, that's somebody's name probably. But that should be Philistia, in order to avoid a famine. So the time away spares her the pain of the famine, but it leaves her with no claim to her land. She abandons her land. She and her entire family leave, and there's nobody living on the land. And so apparently when that happens, after a certain amount of time, what might happen today is the government may claim that land, or it becomes possession of the state because nobody's inhabiting it. And that seems to be what has happened during these 7 years. Okay. Now the key to understanding the story is back in 2 Kings 4:13. It says, "And he said to him, 'Say now to her, see, you have taken all this trouble for us. What is to be done for you? Would you have a word spoken on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army?' And she answered, 'I dwell among my own people.'" Elisha had given her an offer before. "You've been so awesome. Is there anything we can do for you? You know, is there anything that you need?" And she says, "No, I've got my family. You know, I have my people. God has blessed me enough. I don't need anything else." And she allows Elisha to go. But in chapter 8, She no longer has a home, and maybe something has happened in her family, and she needs help. And she remembers what Elisha said, and so she's going to go to the king and hope she can appeal and get her land back.
If she's half the person I think she is, she probably took her family with her.
Yes,
to Philistia.
I would think
to
so.
Avoid the famine.
Exactly. Yeah, that seems to be what it is, because the land must be abandoned. If there's anybody left on the land, she wouldn't have to ask for it back.
Right.
So this is not the famine from last chapter. Remember the famine we talked about last chapter with the siege, where they were starting to boil children and all that other stuff? That was specifically a siege in Samaria. That is not this famine. Elisha did this back in 437, and if the very next verse in 438 says, and Elisha came again to Gilgal where there was a famine in the land. So there was a famine going on outside of the siege. That was a whole different thing. This is just a famine that must have struck the land, and it's right there in the scripture. So the question, why go to Philistia? Because when you think about an Israelite, the Philistines doesn't seem like the first place I would want to move to. You know, that doesn't seem to be friendly territory. But it is not unprecedented. It's a logical choice. Number one, it's closer to Egypt. And Egypt always tended to have more food. It's further down the Sinai Peninsula. Philistia is up against the coast, down further southeast of Jerusalem and all that. Or southwest of Jerusalem. And Egypt is the breadbasket of the ancient world. Common destination throughout the biblical period of people escaping times of hardship. I mean, Christ goes there when he's threatened, right? When he's a baby. So it makes sense. And she's not the first to do it. Look at Genesis 26:1. Now there was a famine in the land besides the former famine that was in the days of Abraham, and Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. So Isaac went to Philistia in a famine before. So there's some precedent. You know, we got to get out of here. Where are we going to go? Well, you're not going to go east. There's nowhere to go east. Your options are fairly limited. Okay? You either have to go north into Syria, which we know that after the last, you know, 8-10 chapters, we're really not getting along with Syria. Now, we'll have some Philistine problems coming up, very obviously. That Goliath guy will be coming, you know, comes on the scene, or came on the scene before. But for now, we don't have that same animosity with Philistia from Israel, so it's a logical choice. It's the closest place she can go where there may be better conditions. Okay? So, her husband was mentioned in chapter 4, but he's not mentioned here. So, there's a good chance that her husband died during those 7 years in Philistia. Okay? Because why is she the one coming to claim the land if her husband is still alive? It doesn't make sense if her husband is still alive. So, the issue with her land, one of the commentators said that property left temporarily was taken over by the crown and was held in trust until reclaimed by the legal owner. They have to come back and reclaim it, because if that person never comes back, we're going to make some profit off of this land if we can. Okay, and someone has taken her land. It might even be the king himself. You know, somebody is now occupying that land. It is still producing goods. It's still producing crops, because at the end she gets restored all the money that was made from that land during those 7 years. So it's still being used. The king was now the recipient of her appeal as the person with primary responsibility under God for the establishment and maintenance of order and justice throughout the kingdom. That was way back to Solomon. That was what you were supposed to do. And in Israel, the end of the seventh year was a proper time for restoration of property, because the seventh year was the Sabbath year, right? Debts were forgiven. Things were restored. That stuff always happened. You can go back to Exodus. You can go to Deuteronomy. You can read through all that, those different kinds of examples of what happened on the Sabbath year, and debts would be canceled. So you didn't have these long-standing debts like that. And if her husband has died, then her situation is even more complicated, because, you know, the idea is maybe the deed is not in her name. You know, she does not have any claim on this land other than saying, no, I'm the person that lived on this land. Well, how are we supposed to know that? It's been 7 years. We don't know who you are. It could be anybody. And so in many ways, her situation parallels that of Naomi and Ruth. I mean, that's essentially what's happened. If you remember that story where Naomi and her husband, they go into a foreign land, and her husband dies. Her two sons marry two women, and then they die. And you've got Naomi and Ruth left, and Ruth says the same thing. I think it's pretty ironic, because the Shunammite woman said in chapter 4, I belong with my people, I have my people. And Ruth tells Naomi, you know, your people should be my people, and your God will be my God. And that, I remember that because that's the verse I used when I proposed to my wife. So, isn't that sweet? points today.
I thought so.
Yeah.
I said yes.
Yeah, she did. It worked out really well. That's really what's happening. You are in a foreign land, and now your husband is gone, and you need somebody to represent her. So she, normally a woman would not be making such a request. She's fled a famine. She's lost her husband, and she seems to be at the mercy of the political system. If she comes back and the king's having a bad day, she's not getting this land back. Okay. So, like I said before, what a coincidence that Gehazi is sitting there talking to the king all at this time when she approaches. And he's telling, and Gehazi, and the king's saying, "Hey, tell me one more of those miracles that Elisha did." And Gehazi says, "Well, I remember this one time he rose this kid back to life." "Really? He rose?" "Yeah, he did this." Da, da, da. And at that moment, the woman walks up. Oh, and by the way, this is her. Right? This is the woman that we're talking about. And he says, "Really? Tell me the story." And she repeats it just like Gehazi had said. And he says, "You know what? I'm in a really good mood today. This is a great story. You're getting your land back and you're getting all the money revenue back that was there when you were gone." So she gets restored over and above for having faith here. Hey, Elisha doesn't even need to appear. Just the reputation of Elisha and knowing that this is the woman and Gehazi's witness are enough to restore her financial security, and this restoration validates his advice about leaving the country in the first place. So Elisha was not just giving advice, he was almost giving a word from the Lord, right? "You need to get out of here for 7 years." Well, she comes back and goes, "Was that really the right advice?" Well, after this meeting with the king, she knows it was the right advice. And so my thought here is that as Christians, our word and reputation ought to be on this same level. The idea where somebody comes in and says, "Well, how do I know I can trust you?" "Well, I worked for John last year." "Oh, well, if John employed you, then you can come work for me." You know, there's a reputation we should carry. If somebody brings up your name and the first thought is laziness or disrespect or apathy or whatever it is, then you're doing it wrong, right? We've got this responsibility to have a reputation beyond reproach, to be blameless even among the unbelievers, right? We are called for a much higher thing. And just because, I mean, Elisha's not even present in this story, and yet his reputation is what drives this train. So I think we're called to a similar level of responsibility. Okay, so before we get to the next section, let's get a little history so we can set that back up. The house of Omri, if you remember, Omri is Ahab's father. So he's the one that had established the kingdom there in Israel with some stability, not so much spirituality, not so much pure things, not so much all that, but stability. And so the house of Omri has held the throne of Israel since 1 Kings 16. And in spite of Elijah's prophecy in 1 Kings 21, remember when he told Ahab, "Your whole dynasty's going away." That was way back in 1 Kings 21. Well, we're in 2 Kings 8, and the kingdom is still there. Okay? One now reads of Ahab's second apostate son holding on to his kingdom with the help of Elijah. I mean, think about that. We've got Jehoram that keeps control in Israel, and mainly because Elisha keeps saving his butt. Right? The raids are coming here. You know, let these people go here. He speaks to the famine. You're going to have more during the siege. You're going to have more food tomorrow at noon than you've ever had before. Right? All that with Elisha. And so you're thinking, if Elijah said this dynasty is going to be done, then why is Elisha helping the son of Ahab? Why is he helping this thing go on and on and on? So 1 Kings 19, 15 through 17 says this, "And the Lord said to him," this is when he said to Elijah when he was leaving the cave. Remember when Elijah fled from Jezebel and hid in the cave? And he says, "Go return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, shall anoint to be king over Israel." I'm reading at an angle here. "And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, so shall Jehu put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death." So he tells Elijah three things. Go anoint the new king of Syria. Go anoint the new king of Israel. And go anoint your successor. Well, only one of those three things has happened. Elisha is the only one that has happened. We still don't have a new king in Syria, and we don't have a new king in Israel yet. Okay, so the question is, has Elijah sabotaged God's plans by failing to anoint Hazael and Jehu? Because he doesn't go do that. That's the command, and he doesn't do it. So is Elijah being disobedient? What's going on here? And this section is going to tell us that the answer is no, because Elisha is going to fulfill this responsibility. If he is taking over Elijah's mantle, Elisha can certainly do this. Okay, so let's read the next section. Now we get into the real ugly politics. "Now Elisha came to Damascus. Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, was sick." Now, we've heard Ben-Hadad forever. There was a Ben-Hadad the first and a Ben-Hadad the second. It's also a kingly name. It's like Caesar. You know, they all have the same last name. So they're not always the same guy, but now this is probably another one. He was sick. And when it was told him, the man of God has come here, the king said to Hazael, take a present with you and go to meet the man of God and inquire of the Lord through him, saying, shall I recover from this sickness? So Hazael went to meet him and took a present with him, all kinds of goods of Damascus, 40 camels loads. When he came and stood before him, he said, your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you, saying, shall I recover from this sickness? And Elisha said to him, go say to him, you shall certainly recover. But the Lord has shown me that he shall certainly die. Well, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? And he fixed his gaze and stared at him until he was embarrassed. And the man of God wept. And Hazael said, why does my Lord weep? He answered, because I know that evil, that the evil that you will do to the people of Israel. You will set on fire their fortresses, and you will kill their young men with the sword and dash in pieces their little ones and rip open their pregnant women. Yikes. And Hazael said, what is your servant, who is but a dog, that he should do this great thing? Elisha answered, the Lord has shown me that you are to be king over Syria. Then he departed from Elisha and came to his master and said to him, what did Elisha say to you? And he answered, he told me that you would certainly recover. But the next day he took the bedcloth and dipped it in water and spread it over his face till he died. And Hazael became king in his place. So that's an interesting little turn of events. So Ben-Hadad has fallen ill. He's probably been king in Syria for about 40 years. Apparently he's not ready to die because he sends. He doesn't end. That's the other way around, right? He sends Hazael, one of his lieutenants, to ask Elisha about his fate. So to his credit, it seems that Ben-Hadad, whether it's one or two, finally realizes that the Lord's prophet is superior to any other prophetic voice. He finally realizes, all right, my prophets don't mean a thing. Go at the man of God's here. Go ask him if I'm going to live. And notice he does the same thing Naaman did. Send him a bunch of stuff. Because apparently, if you went to prophets, they required payment. And he just seems that's the way to do things. Now, Elisha's not going to take that payment, just like Elijah didn't take it from Naaman, or Elisha didn't take it from Naaman. But at the same time, we've got this idea of you pay prophets, and they tell you, I mean, if you're paying prophets, they're going to tell you what you want to hear, right? So, ironically, Ben-Hadad consults Israel's God about his future in much the same way that King Ahaziah of Israel early consulted Beelzebub back in 2 Kings 1. The king of Israel went to consult a pagan god, and the king of a pagan country goes to consult the prophet of God. Okay? Interesting. It appears to have been customary when consulting prophets to offer some payment, as did Naaman, and in this case it is an extravagant gift of 40 camels loads of goods. I don't know how much a camel can carry, but I'd imagine it's pretty substantial. Okay, so now we get this, the emergence of this guy, Hazael. And the messenger, he enters this narrative mysteriously. There's no background, there's no buildup. All of a sudden, he's just there. And we're not told his lineage, and we really don't even know his role. Is he a servant? Is he an officer? We kind of get that idea. He's probably maybe military. I don't know. But he comes from nowhere. He says in 8:13 that he's just a mere dog. Okay, how will a dog be the king? And then we find down here a fragmentary Assyrian text on a basalt statue of King Shalmaneser III refers to him similarly as the son of nobody, doubtless reflecting lowly non-royal origins. So we've got records of him outside of Syria, where he is the king, the son of nobody. The Assyrians and the Syrians aren't the same people, right? You got that?
Outside
of the Bible, yes. Okay, so Elisha says to him, go say to him, you shall certainly recover, but the Lord has shown me that he shall certainly die. Well, that's kind of weird. Go tell him he's going to live, but he's actually going to die. Is he telling him to go tell a lie? That's problematic too, right? We've seen that. We've had that discussion before. But here's what the note from the ESV Study Bible says. It's a little boring, but hang with it. This is what the Hebrew text says, but the word translated to him is sometimes to be read as the negative word not. And so the two words are right here. You can kind of see. Lo, and then lo with an apostrophe. Those are the two words, but they mean one means him and one means not. Okay? And so, depending on which, that would be very easy to mess up. So there may be a possibility that Hazael's Ben-Hadad's going to say, you will certainly not recover. That could be what he's saying. It's not for sure, but that could be what he's saying. If that's the case, then Hazael would be lying to the king when we see it later on. I don't know. But there seems to be have two options. If the Hebrew of Elisha's statement does indeed mean you shall certainly recover, it could have been a truthful prediction about the course of Ben-Hadad's sickness that was still negated when Hazael murdered him.
That's what I
think. Yeah, Ben-Hadad could have recovered, but he's not going to recover because you're murdering him. I think that makes a lot of sense. Okay? And alternatively, someone suggested that Elisha's statement was in fact deceptive to lull the king into the false sense of security so that he would be unprepared for Hazael's attack. That's a little more problematic. But there you go. So here's the characterization of Hazael, because he tells the story and he tells the prophecy, and it seems that the Lord gives him this prophecy about Hazael at that moment. And he sees, you know, he sees all the horrible things that are going to happen. If you remember Lord of the Rings, when Frodo and Sam look into the mirror in Lothlorien? Well, if you don't, just hang with the nerdy conversation for a minute. But they see everything that could happen in the Shire, and the Shire's getting burned down, and the whole place is getting torn apart, and it freaks them out. And I think that's what Elisha sees right now, is what Hazael is going to bring to the table. And he starts crying about it. He starts weeping about it. And Hazael's...
The older generation, it'd be the Christmas Carol... Where they look into the Christmas.
There you go, the ghost of Christmas future. Yeah, the ghost of Christmas yet to come, I think, is what it says. Is how Dickens did it, yeah. So, I like my Lord of the Rings better, but that's fine. I love Dickens too, so, you know. You hit a good spot there with Charles Dickens. Probably the only one in the room, but there you go. So Hazael said, "Why does my Lord weep?" And he answered, "Because I know the evil that you will do the people of Israel. You'll set fire to their fortresses. You'll kill your young men with a sword. You'll dash in pieces their little ones and rip open their pregnant women." I mean, that is horrible. This description may lead us to believe option number one is correct, as we talked about on the last page, because the truth is Ben-Hadad will certainly not recover, because Hazael is going to kill him and take his place. Okay? So this reminded me of Shakespeare a little bit. Wow, we're getting all kinds of nerdy this morning. Okay? So Hazael said, "What is your servant who is but a dog that he should do this great thing?" And Elisha answered, "The Lord has shown me that you are to be king over Syria." And if anybody's read Macbeth, Macbeth early in that play confronts the weird sisters out on the moor, out on wherever they are, and they give him a bit of a prophecy. And they say, "Hail Thane of Cawdor, hail Thane of Glamis, and then hail the king to be hereafter." And he goes, "Wait a second, I'm not even trying to do anything." And Macbeth says, "This doesn't make any sense, because I'm Thane of Glamis, but I'm not Thane of Cawdor." And then a messenger comes up and says, "Oh, by the way, the Thane of Cawdor betrayed the king, and now you're going to get to be take his spot." And then he goes, "Wait a second, I'm now Thane of Glamis, and now I'm Thane of Cawdor, and they said I'm going to be king. How is that going to work?" And it just starts, you know, driving at him. And Macbeth does not wait to see how he wants to be king. He wants to move things along and get rid of the king so he can become king himself. And his wife definitely helps in that whole thing. But Macbeth never would have gone down this road had these sisters not told him, "You're going to be king once hereafter." And I don't know that Hazael goes back and kills him if Elisha doesn't tell him, "You're going to be the next king." And when you're told you're going to be the next king, who wants to wait around for that? You know, it's good to be the king. You like that sort of thing. Yep.
The man after God's own heart, David.
Right.
Was told the
There's
same
your.
Thing. And he said, "I will not touch the Lord's anointed."
There's your difference between a believer and an unbeliever, right? And that's exactly right. All right. So that was the best picture I could find. I don't know if that's historically accurate, because he's probably not wearing that, but I just thought there'd be a picture. That's all I could find. So he departed from Elisha, came to his master, said to him, "What did Elisha say to you?" And he answered, "He told me you would certainly recover." But the next day he took the bedcloth, dipped it in water, spread it over his face till he died, and Hazael became king in his place. So Hazael acts just as Elisha expects. Elisha's weeping when he finds out Hazael's going to be king. And Hazael lives up to billing. You know, he kills this guy to become king. Just how or why Hazael is able to seize power isn't really clear. We don't really know his background. Was he a really popular soldier, and so he's got an army behind him? We don't really know, because he's not in the lineage. It's kind of weird that he becomes king, but apparently he had something set up in the background where he was able to take power. but his ability to do so continues Elijah's life work, because Elijah's prophecy was, "Anoint Hazael king of Syria." It vindicates Elisha's prediction, and it reinforces the Lord's authority over all nations. God is sovereign and puts people where he wants to put them. And Hazael reigned for about 40 years, and he's going to be one of Israel's most bitter enemies when the history comes down to it. All right, so the rest of chapter 8, we got a good number of verses, but it really is pretty simple. And if you remember when we were in 1 Kings, it kept talking about the kingly formula. So-and-so reigned in Jerusalem this many years, and he died this year, and he slept with his fathers, and he did this and this and this, and can we not look at all the other exploits that they did in the books of blah, 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 right? We haven't seen that in a while. That's the Message translation. After not using the formula for the rise and death of kings since 2 Kings 1, The author now turns to data about Joram, Jehoram, and Ahaziah. We get a flash into Judah, because we haven't heard much about Judah here. And the reason for the return to the earlier format is so the stage can be set for the political intrigue, religious cleansing, and social upheaval that's going to happen in the next chapter. So the rest of this chapter is going to set us up for next week, so we're going to have a bit of a cliffhanger at the end here. And so, in other words, politically, it's about to get messy. It's about to get ugly in Israel and Judah. So we get two kings here in Judah, King Jehoram, who reigned 7 or 8 years. Remember, we had a Jehoram up north, too, so this is the second Jehoram. And then a King Ahaziah. We also had an Ahaziah up north. Now we have one in the south, and he only reigns for 1 year. Okay, so let's read the verses to finish out the chapter. In the 5th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, when Jehoshaphat was king of Judah, Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. And he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, as the house of Ahab had done, for the daughter of Ahab was his wife. This guy's from Judah, and he's married to Ahab's daughter. You see that problem coming? And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, yet the Lord was not willing to destroy Judah for the sake of David, his servant, Davidic covenant, since he promised to give a lamp to him and to his sons forever. In his days, Edom revolted from the rule of Judah and set up a king of their own. Then Joram passed over to Zair with all his chariots and rose by night. And he and his chariot commander struck the Edomites who had surrounded him, but his army fled home. So Edom revolted from the rule of Judah to this day. Then Libnah revolted at the same time. That's a city southwest of Jerusalem. And now the rest of the acts of Joram and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? So Joram slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, and Ahaziah his son reigned in his place. So in the 12th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaziah was 22 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Athaliah. She was a granddaughter of Omri, king of Israel. That means Ahab's daughter. He also walked in the way of the house of Ahab and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, as the son of Ahab had done, for he was son-in-law to the house of Ahab. He went with Joram, the son of Ahab, to make war against Hazael, king of Syria, at Ramoth-Gilead. And the Syrians wounded Joram. And King Joram returned to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds that the Syrians had given him at Ramah when he fought against Hazael, king of Syria. And Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, went down to see Joram, the son of Ahab, in Jezreel because he was sick. All right, so more irony here. First introduced briefly in 1 Kings 22. This king is mentioned again in 2 Kings 1:17, this Joram or Jehoram. His name appears as Joram, which is also the name of the king of Israel in this period. This Israelite king is himself called Jehoram in such verses as 1:17 and 3:1. And at precisely the point when the southern monarchy has come to resemble the northern monarchy most closely in its worship, their kings are called by the same name. Isn't that right? When the south is really bad, as bad as they've ever been, the two kings have the same name. I think it's kind of interesting. And one must work hard to distinguish their actions in the text. So if you get Jehoram and Jehoram and Ahaziah confused, it's okay, because I think that's what he means to do. You can't tell who's who, because they worship the same way. They worship like the house of Ahab. Okay? So we get three comments on Jehoram's reign. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel as the house of Ahab had done, primarily because the daughter of Ahab, Athaliah, was his wife. The author claims that Yahweh only permits Jehoram and Judah to survive for the sake of David, his servant. The only reason Judah stays is because of the Davidic covenant. And Jehoram is unable to put down an Edomite revolt and then another revolt in Libnah, and just manages to escape with his life, which demonstrates just how weak Judah has become since the glory days of David and Solomon. If he can't defeat Edom, which has always been pretty easy for David and Solomon. 2 Chronicles 21 adds to the picture of the weak king by telling of attacks from the Philistines and Arabs who had given tribute to Jehoram's father. So nations that once paid Israel are now attacking Israel or Judah at this point. So it's bad. They're not strong, they're not righteous, and they're obviously not spiritually pure. So remember, his father Jehoshaphat had made a peace with the king of Israel in the aftermath of the struggles that arose out of the division of the kingdoms under Jeroboam and Rehoboam. Remember when they went up there and all the prophets put the horns on and told them that they were going to win the battle? And he said, and Jehoshaphat said, could you bring a real prophet so we can do this? Remember all that? And from Jehoshaphat's reign onward, the fortunes of the house of Omri and the house of David were closely interconnected. Once you intermarry, well, the kingdoms are now tied together. And once Athaliah marries into the kingdom of Judah, now Judah and Israel are almost exactly the same. And just like Jezebel took Ahab even further into Baal worship, Athaliah is going to take Judah further into that kind of worship. So there was intermarriage between two families. Jehoram had married the daughter of Ahab, and the two kingdoms followed a similar religious policy as the house of Ahab had done. Right? Yes?
I know this is a depressing place
yes.
to be. I wonder if you could stop just a little bit short. We have something we need to do.
Oh.
As a class. Okay. Is this a good place to stop?
Sure, we can stop right there.
At a very low note.
Yes. And we have to anyway. The bell just rang.
Okay, all right.
It is my pleasure. As a